So we continue the Bhakti Yoga, the path of devotion. In our last few classes, we had discussed about the necessity of Guru, spiritual teacher. And we have gone into quite details. The conclusion is, without the grace of a Guru, a spiritual teacher, it is impossible to progress in spiritual life. And so, Hinduism had recognized this fact and had given such a vast importance, emphasis. And as a result of it, a big tradition had developed, Guru Sampradaya, a Guru cult almost, like a God's cult. A Guru sometimes had even replaced God himself. Guru himself takes the place of a God. Ramakrishna Mission is an example of that. We worship our Guru. We worship Ramakrishna. How did it develop? The disciples of Sri Ramakrishna made Ramakrishna himself as the Supreme God. So we call him Guru Maharaj and we worship him. There is nothing wrong in it. This Guru cult had saved Hinduism from the ravages of history. There were other religions, for example, Buddhism. 500 years after Buddha had started this religion, it had completely disappeared from India. What was the reason? The cause, the main cause was there was no established Guru cult. Why was there no established Guru cult? Because, as we will discover later on, the Guru cult also depends upon certain other factors. For example, a deep faith in a book, deep faith in divine, in the divine, in God. So every other religion, major religion, excepting Buddhism, always relied upon the divine. And that divine reveals his will or his manifestation in the form of a book. This is what we call a scripture. And the scriptures of Hindus are called Vedas. And even if everything disappears in this world, all the teachers, but if one single Veda remains, again the whole cycle will start. Because the power of the book is so great. We will come to that point a little later. This Guru cult has saved India because the Hindus clung tenaciously to this Guru. This Guru cult had done one great service. What was that? That it had prevented centralization of a religion. Now what happens when Guru cult is not prominent, the religion tends to become centralized. For example, Christianity, Catholic Christianity. All the power must be traced to the Pope, from Jesus Christ to Saint Peter, and he had handed over the keys to Saint Peter and then his their disciple. These are called popes. Now, all the authority is invested in the popes. Supposing somebody can dispose of the pope, all the Catholics would be at a loss to know what is their religion, what are they supposed to do. There will be fights and quarrels. Whereas what happened in India, in Hinduism, there is no centralized authority who is sitting like a pope and says, I excommunicate you, I will do. No. Instead, what happened? Hinduism depended upon Guru cult, Guru Sampradaya. So, for local people, even in the remotest village, a few people, they have a person whom they used to worship as a guru. And that person becomes everything. What happens to the rest of the India, it doesn't really matter. As long as their guru is there, he is there to guide them. So you see, in every village, there will be gurus. And what happens if holy persons are not there? Every person is not a holy person like me. I have got only 5 holes, you know. What happens? So they made an unbreakable tradition of gurus. These are called kula gurus, family gurus. Doesn't matter. A priest will be there. That priest will be a family guru. But in India, Hindus are very clever people, you know. They pay a little bit of pranami and other things. When they want spiritual progress, they will go to a holy man. But these kula gurus also acted as a buffer. When times are bad, when really holy people are not available, then these family gurus, local gurus, acted as a bridge, and they prevented the decay of Hinduism. So this is how the tradition has come. Now, we also have to remember that Sri Ramakrishna had attained the supreme knowledge long before any of his gurus had really come to him. If you have read the biography of Sri Ramakrishna, you will see he attained the highest realization before any guru came to him. But on that account, he did not discard or discount the need of a guru. After that, one after the other, starting with Bhairavi Brahmani, came gurus and they taught him what he had already known, but through a what is called direct attack. What Sri Aurobindo calls, Sri Ramakrishna had attacked God in a frontal way. There is no roundabout way. By his intense yearning, power of yearning, he had taken the fortress as it were by storm. But we are not that qualified. We do not have that much of yearning. So we have to follow roundabout way, like, you know, a disabled people's doorway. Nowadays it is illegal for institutions like ours not to have, you know, disabled toilets for disabled people, doorways for disabled people. We must have. Otherwise, they can close our institutions. Don't take advantage of it. Recently, one person, you know, was disabled, and she threatened, "I come to your center and I cannot get up from the toilet unless 2 people, so we have to spend £50 and put in the toilet some support." Our own devotee. Legally, she has that right. If anyone of you complain that I cannot go to the toilet, then we'll be forced to shell down the money and put disabled toilet, special toilet. Everywhere is public, they provide it. So Sri Ramakrishna had taken God as it were by storm. He had demanded, "I have to see you." In that case, that is all right. But he also was intelligent enough to know that all of us, we cannot attain God by that means. That is why, to reinforce faith in the guru cult, that he had done 2 things. But he himself had accepted several gurus. That is not an ideal, that you should accept several gurus. I already raised the point. He did it for a special purpose. In our case, only one guru, main guru. So the second thing that he did was, he established a guru sampradaya. He gave mantras to his disciples, and his disciples gave mantras to their disciples, and their disciples are giving mantras to other people. So a tradition is there, established there. So this guru cult has a lot of advantages are there. To summarize, the guru cult has prevented Hindu religion from developing into a universal church. It also enabled it to survive the ravages of history. Second, at the individual level, the guru cult can be a great help to the beginner in spiritual life. Third, to love an intangible spiritual reality, an unknown God, is really difficult for a beginner. By loving a living spiritual personality in whom are manifested some of the attributes of the chosen ideal, the disciple progresses quickly in the path of devotion. not only in the path of devotion, in any spiritual path. There are four spiritual paths. These are called four yogas. You are familiar with it. The path of devotion, the path of meditation, the path of knowledge, and the path of selfless activity. Again, to remind you, why four? Why not three? Why not five? Why on exactly four? Do you know the answer? I'm glad you don't remember it. Only four because each one of us have four faculties. We have emotion, we have intellect, we have will, and we have the propensity for activity. So, in each one of us, it is very rare that all the four are equally dominant in any one of us. That was only possible in the case of Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda. But in each one of us, invariably, one of these faculties would be dominant. And what is that faculty which is dominant in most of us? No, emotion. Karma Yoga is not that easy. You must be completely emotionless to be a Karma Yogi. Because if you are doing some good and somebody comes and criticizes, then if you feel bad, depressed, then you are not fit for Karma Yoga. If somebody praises you, you are wonderful, you are my God, then also you should not feel happy. At least not too happy. Then you are not fit for Karma Yoga. We are emotional creatures. Emotion is so predominant in us. What is emotion? What is email? You know what is email? Electronic mail. What is emotion? Electronic motion. One moment we are in the seventh heaven, the other moment we are down in the seventh hell. How do we know that we have dominant? If somebody praises you, this is a home test, an instrument for home test. If someone praises you and your blood pleasure goes up, and if somebody criticizes you and blood pressure goes up, you are a sure candidate that you have only emotion. And if you have emotion, you have no choice to take any other path. Because that is the treasure you have. It's not bad. Every faculty is good. Take that faculty and take it out from all other attachments and direct it towards, focus it and direct it towards God. That is what is called the path of devotion. What is the difference between emotion and devotion? When the same faculty is directed towards anything other than God, that is called emotion. When the same faculty is directed towards God, that is called devotion. So also the other three paths. So these four faculties, if they can help us join ourselves to God, they deserve the name yoga. Yoga means, you know, to join. The individual is joined with the Supreme. The individual soul, Jivatma, is joined with the Paramatma. And that which joins us is called yoga. So if emotion joins us with God, that is called devotion. If activity joins us with God, that is called karma yoga. If our will joins us towards God, our concentration, meditation joins us with God, that is called Raja Yoga, Dhyana Yoga. And if knowledge, intellect joins us with God, that is called Jnana Yoga. That's why there are not three yogas, there are not five yogas, but there are exactly four yogas. And every religion is only an expression of either one or more of these faculties. Every religion, invariably, there is nothing else other than this. So, having a guru is very important for us because we cannot love an intangible reality, an unknown God. That's why it is very important to have this guru, Guru Sampradaya. That's what Sri Ramakrishna had done. He became, as it were, he connects us with the Supreme Divine in the form of a thread, sutra. A guru is nothing but a sutra, or that which joins us, bridge, a bridge between individual soul and divine soul. That's all. The whole Ramayana is only an example of this thing. It's how the individual soul is joined with the Supreme Soul. Do you know that? All the mythologies, Ramayana, Mahabharata and other mythological stories, they are but symbolical stories. What is Ramayana? That there was a king called Rama, and he married a wife called Sita, and this Sita was kidnapped by a demon called Ravana. Then Rama goes in search of Sita, and he gets information about this demon. He crosses the ocean and conquers the demon, brings back or becomes united with the separated wife. That is the external story, the shell. What is the symbolism of this? Rama is the Supreme Lord, and his wife Sita is the individual soul, and they always want to be together. Who is Ravana? Ravana is ignorance, which, as it were, separated the individual soul from the Supreme Soul. And Ravana, as you know in this story, had taken Sita to his place, where, which is the modern Sri Lanka. That is, it is not Sri Lanka, it is a realm of ignorance. An ocean, as it were, separates these two. Knowledge and ignorance cannot cohabit together. It's impossible. Light and darkness cannot remain together at the same time. So Rama, it is Rama who, what does he do? He sends someone in search of Sita. Whom does he send? Hanuman. What is Hanuman? Symbolically, Hanuman is guru or the teacher. What is the function of the teacher? He goes to the distressed individual and he tells, do not fear. God is looking after you. He is very much aware of your condition, miserable condition. And very soon he will come, he will release you from this. Having given that assurance to the individual soul, who was on the point of death, as it were, he is, as it were, a new life is infused into by just hearing this message. And then he comes back to Rama and tells that this soul doesn't want anything else excepting you. Now you must go. So the guru carries God, as it were, to, because you see in this story, it is Hanuman carries Rama and Lakshman on his shoulders, goes to Sri Lanka, and there Rama, along with his assistants, kill all the demonic forces and release the soul, and ever afterwards they were happy. This is the symbolism of Ramayana. So also every other mythological story. So a guru stands as a bridge, as it were, between the individual and the Paramatman, the divine. And what happens to the bridge once you cross to the real realm? What happens to the bridge? The bridge is nothing other than the Supreme Soul himself. A guru is only a manifestation of God's grace available, apprehensible by the disciple. So without a guru, it is impossible. As I mentioned many times, once somebody asks, Swami Brahmananda, can we not reach God? Can we not realize God without the help of a guru? And he says, you know, even if you want to become an expert pickpocket, you need a guru. What to speak of this almost impossible task of realizing God? Without guru's grace, it is impossible. So what happens when a guru is there? It's a very loving personality. Now, do not mistake love for an emotion. Again and again, I have cautioned you so many times. Love is primarily manifestation of knowledge. Suppose a good teacher, or a good teacher, do you know what a good teacher does? Well, do you know Sri Ramakrishna's teaching? And how many types of physicians are there? Three types of physicians. And who is the best physician? If the patient doesn't take medicine, he will put his knee on the chest of the patient and catches hold of his throat, opens the mouth and forces the medicine. He is the best type of physician. So is he doing it lovingly or not?
Yes.
Who is the most loving? He is the most loving. Why? Because he is doing it for the good of the patient. So a first-class guru is one who sacrifices his life for the welfare of his student. That is why Swami Vivekananda, and we have not recognized the greatness of Sri Ramakrishna yet, though emotionally we shed tears. We have not recognized Swami Vivekananda hymns Sri Ramakrishna as what? Prana Arpana Jagata Tarana. He who had offered every drop of his blood for the welfare of this world. He died because he has sacrificed. There was no need for him to do as much effort as he had done. So, to love an intangible spiritual reality, an unknown God, is really difficult for a beginner. By loving a living spiritual personality in whom are manifested some of the attributes of the chosen ideal, the disciple progresses quickly in the path of devotion. That's what a guru cult really helps us do it. And by surrendering his will to the will of the guru, by serving him and undergoing sacrifices for his sake, the disciple learns to practice true self-surrender to God. You know, it is very easy to say that surrender ourselves to God. It is very, very difficult. Why? Because, first of all, because we do not know how to sacrifice ourselves. And secondly, if you think that you have surrendered yourself to God, how do you know that God is approving of your actions? I gave an example many times. Supposing you are lovingly worshipping a picture of Vishnu or Kali, whatever it is, and you have prepared a payasa. It is half cooked, the rice is half cooked, and instead of sugar you have put salt, and very, you know, happily you offered it to God. What does the God do? You know, always this one thing wonderful about Hinduism. The gods are smiling, you know, cheese. Always they are eating cheese only. With hands like that, you know, go on looking at it. You have offered this, you know, horrible payasa to him. But his face doesn't change, the same loving face. It's only later on you discover what you have done. But do the same thing to a living guru. Simply will slap you on the face and says, get out. So these reactions at what God is thinking about us is not available excepting through the guru. That's why it's very important to have a living guru. And also, you know, people have very wrong understandings about spiritual progress. They say God realization. Suppose a person goes on sitting, closing the eyes and meditating. And by the power of concentration, slowly he perceives. His imagination becomes living like in a dream. And he thinks, I am very spiritual. But how do we know that he is really spiritual? unless he comes into this marketplace of this world, faces the, you know, the good things and bad sides of in this world, nobody can find out who is spiritually progressive or not. So by living with a guru, what happens? Instantaneously, we know the reactions of the guru. And through that, and many times it's very painful, but through that we learn to love God. And which if something is wrong, the guru immediately corrects us, which the our idea of God doesn't do it. So it is very necessary to have a living guru. So supposing somebody has realized God and he comes back to this world, what do you think he beholds? Everywhere, what does he see? It is not seeing God with closed eyes that is God realization. It is seeing God in everything that we come across, a tiger. When we come across a tiger, what do we see? A ferocious animal. But when a great soul comes across, what does he see? A tiger God. He is not afraid. He may take care, but he is not afraid. If he sees a snake, it is a snake God. If he is a wicked person, he is a wicked God. He is God. What is important? God, seeing God is important. This idea is very important for us, which I will be coming shortly, because when we use symbols, worshipping of images, either iconic or aniconic, whatever, it is not seeing what we are seeing in front of us, our imposing the idea of God in them. For example, you have an image of Vishnu. And is that image Vishnu or God? If you think it is, then you are totally unspiritual. But if you impose the idea that through this I am supposed to learn what God is, then that becomes a helpful aid for our spiritual progress. We will come to that later on. A guru is the highest symbol of God. By learning to look upon the guru as a manifestation of God, we start somewhere and then we extend that vision to everything else. Just like Gopala's mother had done it. Do you remember? First she saw Gopala where in Sri Ramakrishna, you know, Gopala was entering into Sri Ramakrishna's body, coming out, entering, making this illiterate woman understand, illiterate from our point of view, but most literate from spiritual point of view, that her chosen deity is no different from Sri Ramakrishna. This incident has two significant meanings. One, that we consider Sri Ramakrishna as a special manifestation of God, God incarnation, like Jesus, like Buddha. From this point of view, that this woman is learning that your chosen deity is manifested in the form of Sri Ramakrishna. But that is one meaning. The other meaning is there are many people who do not consider Sri Ramakrishna as an incarnation of God. It doesn't matter whether you consider him as an incarnation of God or not. What is important is whether he can help you to go towards God. So if you take him as an ideal, as a model, then that would be very fine. So from the second point of view, this Gopala's mother is learning that this is a man and my Gopala is manifesting as this man. And after a few days, her Gopala was coming inside and outside of the disciples of Sri Ramakrishna. Okay, not only that man, but this man also is my Gopala. The other man also is my Gopala. And slowly her vision extended. So that all the devotees that were visiting Sri Ramakrishna are just manifestations of her chosen deity. But if the matter ends there, what about the non-devotees of Sri Ramakrishna? Are they manifestations of God or not? So one day she went to this Panihati chariot festival. And that day, she had a universal Vishwarupa Darshana of her Shisa Gopala in the priests. If anybody can see God in a priest, his vision, God vision is complete. You know, this is the name in India for a priest. We call it Pujari. Ari means enemy. Puja means worship. Pujari means enemy of worship, you know. Like Murari, Madanari, Kamsari. So if anybody can see God in the priests, the chariot, and the people who came to witness that, in everything, wherever her drishti was, sight was going, that sight she was only seeing her Gopala. The whole universe is nothing but a manifestation of her Gopala. This important factor, that this world is nothing but a manifestation of God, was revealed to her at that moment. From that time onwards, there is nothing in this world which is not a manifestation of her God for Gopala. What a marvelous change had come as a result of it, that, you know, Hindus consider Westerners as mlechas, untouchables. But Sister Nivedita, that's why accepting Holy Mother, and very few people dared, even though she was such a noble woman. Her name itself was noble, most noble Margaret. But Holy Mother recognized, this is my child, my, you know, cookie, baby daughter, she used to call her. But others were not prepared to accept. It's because of their devotion to Holy Mother, they had accepted. This is part of history. It's very interesting and important also for us to understand that Swami Vivekananda introduced Sister Nivedita to Holy Mother. He sent Nivedita to Holy Mother. He did not go. He sent her. And he was waiting with palpitating heart. How will Holy Mother receive her? Because if had Holy Mother not received her, just imagine what would have been the condition of Sister Nivedita. Why Holy Mother? First of all, she was a Sri Ramakrishna's wife. Second, she was an Orthodox Brahmin. Third, she was an Orthodox Brahmin widow coming from a village. She was not educated. Educated people somehow, you know, modern, they can accept. If she accepts, then there is a great chance that the other society will, all of the society, slowly, gradually they will accept. Otherwise, suppose if she had been sent to, first of all, people to like Gopala's mother before her realization, do you think she would have accepted? Just to remind you, how orthodox Gopala's mother was as a widow. She was also a Brahmin. She was also a child widow. You know, in the beginning, they say about Hindu Brahmin widows, they won't put salt in the curry until they wash it three times. So that was the type of lady this Gopala's mother was before she was transformed by this spiritual vision. It's an important point. Any spiritual vision must transform a person into a nobler person, loving person, truthful person, and loving everybody. No exclusions are allowed. One day, this Gopala's mother was serving Sri Ramakrishna. Just imagine, after all these visions, and in the beginning, and accidentally, Sri Ramakrishna's hand touched the spoon with which she was serving the rice to Sri Ramakrishna. He did not touch her. His hand touched the spoon with which the rice is being taken out. You know what she did? She threw the rice, the pot, spoon, everything, until it is scrubbed 100 times, she would not accept this. That was the type of orthodoxy that existed. So when Holy Mother had lovingly received, not only received, it was a revolutionary thing There is a photograph that she kept. Sister Nivedita made her sit on her own cot. For us nowadays, looks, what is the big deal? No, in those days, that was a revolutionary thing for anybody to do. When Swami Vivekananda heard, he almost, you know, danced with joy. Do you know? Mother had accepted Nivedita. And because of that, others also had accepted Sister Nivedita. So this lady who was so orthodox, she practically died in the lap of Sister Nivedita. That is the transformation that has come. So that universal vision, what are we discussing? That see God as a manifestation of God in the Guru first. Do not go on seeing anything else. Why is it important? Because, you see, as long as the Guru is at a distance, then our reverence for anything like that. Your wife also, it is like that. Before marriage, because they meet only once in a week, this love is so intense. As soon as they come and start living together, all problems will start. As I told you, you know, as the wife expects before marriage, suspects after marriage, respects him only after death. If no judgment had to be passed on the Guru, no judgment is whatever he is, even if he is, if you go near and he is found to be anything that you don't like in him, do not pass any judgment. Once you have accepted, accept him, because he is your Guru. That's all. And this vision has to be slowly extended from the Guru to the disciples or people related to him, and then other people, then other people, then other people. This is how spiritual progress is made. Do you remember the incident? M had visited Kamarpukur during the lifetime of Sri Ramakrishna. And he had a wonderful experience. The moment he entered Kamarpukur, saw that every dust particle of Kamarpukur was shining like the dust of gold. Every person was emanating a divine light. I have never seen any Kamarpukur or Jairambati people like that. The dullest people I have seen in my life, if not worse. Anyway, when he came back, he was in an ecstatic state. So he Sri Ramakrishna asked him, how did you find? He said, I was in a blissful state. I was enjoying divine bliss. I would like to go another time. Ramakrishna said, no. Why? Because it was the grace of Sri Ramakrishna which made him experience Kamarpukur in that particular way. Later on he visited Kamarpukur, Jairambati. But you know what respect he had. After Sri Ramakrishna's passing away, many, many times M used to visit Dakshineshwar, the beloved place where he received so many visions, so many instructions, so much love. And he used to, as soon as he comes near that big gate, he used to fall Sashtanga Pranam. And other people may be wondering, why is this person making, after all, this is the same dirty place. No, it is not dirty place. It is associated with his Guru. And anybody who is associated with the Guru is sacred. To give one more example, you know, this Ramakrishna's nephew, Ramlal Dada. He was a great man in his own way, but he also did lot of mischief to Holy Mother and other people. But how did the direct disciples looked upon him? Guru Putreshu Guruvat. The children of Guru are to be looked upon exactly like a Guru. Their reverence did not come down because he was not up to the mark, up to the standard. Their only thing is, this our Guru's nephew, full stop, and we will give him the highest respect. You know, so that is a point which we have to keep in mind. A Guru is there as a manifestation of God for us, as a target, so that we are able to see God, which means you should never pass any judgments. Once you accept, he is greater than God himself, so far as you are concerned, as disciple is concerned. So by surrendering one's will to the will of the Guru, by serving him and undergoing sacrifices for his sake, the disciple learns to practice true self-surrender to God. And I will give you an example how. It's an imaginary example. One man went to a great holy man and said, "I want to be your disciple." The holy man said, "Is that so? Are you ready to whatever I ask you, that you are prepared to do?" He said, "Yes. You come tomorrow morning." So next morning the man went, and there was a small hillock, and a big boulder was lying at the bottom of the hillock. The guru said, "I want this boulder to be put on the top of the hill." It was a back-breaking task. So the disciple went on pushing whole day, back-breaking work. He pushed, and before sunset, somehow succeeded in putting it on the top of the hill. And he leisurely, the guru walked to the hill and gave one small push with his foot. And then again the boulder came rolling down to the bottom. He said, "Tomorrow morning you put it here." So this went on for a few days. So the disciple couldn't see the point. So one day he got very annoyed and said, "What is the meaning of this? I take so much trouble to push this boulder to the top of the hill, and you just come there and push it with your toe and make me do it the same thing." The guru said, "You don't need to come from tomorrow onwards. Get out." This is a Sufi story or a Zen story, whatever. What is the point? Is the point to take the boulder to the top of the hill? No. The point is, whatever the guru says, do it without thinking whether it is justified or unjustified, whether it is useful, useless. You just close your eyes and do it. And there is an incident in the life of Sri Ramakrishna. There was a very tender, soft-hearted disciple, Swami Yogananda. And one day Sri Ramakrishna showed him some cockroach in his room and said, "Go and kill it, take it outside, kill it and come back." So this man took it outside. He was too tender even to kill a cockroach. So he said, "My dear, who is seeing it? I will just, he will not ask me. He told me to do it, he will not ask me." So he threw it out and then came back. The first thing Sri Ramakrishna asked was, "Did you kill the cockroach?" And you know, he couldn't say that I did. See, he told, "No, I just left it." Sri Ramakrishna became very grave and said, "If you disobey me in these small matters, tomorrow you will also disobey me in bigger matters. Never again do this kind of thing." What is the point? Is it killing the cockroach? The point is that whatever the guru says, he must do it. And the disciples of Sri Ramakrishna were such. Sri Ramakrishna told Swami Adbhutananda not to sleep at night. And now after that, he slept. He didn't have one wink of sleep. Only daytime, he used to sleep 2-3 hours. There are so many instances I can tell you about this kind of incidents. How strong was their love and self-surrender? You see, love means self-surrender. It's an entirely different subject. I will not go into it. But the point is, the guru is there so that we can practice self-surrender to God. And we start with, the target is, here is a manifestation of God, the guru. Or it can be a holy man. That is it. There is nothing else. Without the self-surrender, one cannot kill the ego. Self-surrender means complete annihilation of the ego. Without that, God realization is impossible. Now, the point in self-surrender is, if we know that the Guru or God is always only expressing joy and never giving us any trouble and always, you know, feeding us with sweetmeats, rasagullas, rajabhogas, then all of us would be very willing to surrender ourselves to such a guru. But if God or guru is there prepared to give blow after blow without rhyme or reason, Are you still prepared to surrender yourself to God? You see, self-surrender means no question. It is not a question of good or bad, right or wrong, justified or unjustified. It's a question of you surrender your will, whatever the master does. Some devotee complained to Sri Ramakrishna. So we surrendered ourselves to you. And what is this, the way you are treating us? And then he said, you see, it is my goat. If I like, I will cut it at the tail. I will cut it at the throat. Do you understand the point? Suppose you want to cut a goat. It's your goat. You want to cut your... So what is the human way of doing it according to you? Cut the throat. But supposing you are a person, leisurely you tie the goat, cut a little bit of the tail and go on smoking half an hour here and there, then cut a little bit of the leg. Suppose you witness such a scene. What would be your idea? What would other people think about you? You are the cruelest person on earth. You want to kill the goat? Kill it at one stroke. The idea is don't give any pain to it. But what Sri Ramakrishna is telling, it is my goat. If I want, I will cut it at the throat. If I want, I will cut it at little by little, from the beginning at the tail. What is it to you? And if God decides to take the same stance, are we able to say we still surrender ourselves to you? This concept is so beautifully illustrated in the story of the Job in the Bible, Old Testament. Do you remember story of the Job? So these are the advantages of a guru cult. Only those who have had the good fortune to serve and remain in close contact with an illumined preceptor can know what the guru's blessings really mean. Sri Shankaracharya says that the blessings of the guru is nishkraya. Nishkraya means there is no recompense. You can never pay back anything. He is giving you the highest. If somebody gives you infinite, what can you give in return? Just to get rid of the debt. Can you do anything? So there is no recompense for it. It cannot be paid back. There is no substitute for it either on this earth or elsewhere. So the Prasna Upanishad speaks of six young seekers of truth. There is a Upanishad called Prasna Upanishad. Prasna means question. The Upanishad starts with six disciples approaching the Guru and put six questions. Each one of them put one question. And that is why it is titled as Prasna Upanishad. So in that, the greatness of the Guru is revealed. The disciples worshipped the feet of their Guru and exclaimed with deep devotion, "You are indeed our Father who have ferried us across this ocean of ignorance to the other shore. Tvam hi nah pita yo asmakam avidyayah paramparam tharayasi iti." But this is the greatness, the positive points about guru cult. That is why any religion who has this guru cult, which has this guru cult, that will produce saints in abundance, as Hinduism had proved it. But there is a caution. One should never lose respect for the Guru. That is the first caution. Whatever, even if you find something in the Guru, never lose respect. One should never compare Gurus. Anybody who is a true disciple of any Guru, never compares and says, "My Guru is great, and the other Gurus are not great." Supposing, for example, You have the good fortune of becoming the disciple of Sri Ramakrishna. Then you come across another person who is the disciple of local person. Does pride, is there any place for pride? Look, I am the disciple of Sri Ramakrishna. Who is this fellow? He is only a disciple of ordinary person. I studied with Einstein himself. This fellow, a third class village mathematics teacher. He is his guru. Never compare gurus. Because what is the reason? Because every guru is only one guru. God alone is the guru manifested in all these forms. That is the first principle. Second principle is, it is not that any guru, even if you come across the greatest guru, Sri Ramakrishna himself, unless you have the capacity to receive, even he cannot help you. Suppose a donkey goes to Einstein as a student. Do you think it will become another great scientific genius? You see, this is what we forget. We only see the greatness of the guru, but at the same time we don't see what we are in ourselves. The best disciple is one who is imbued with tremendous humility. He never compares his guru with any other guru. He respects every guru. Should have respect for all the gurus. And the third point is very important. One should never become proud because of one's greatness of one's guru. Suppose my guru is Sri Ramakrishna himself. Should I become proud because of that? So what happens if I become proud? That means I am only proving both the unworthiness of myself and also the unworthiness of my guru. If my guru is great, then I must be also great. Suppose people see me, they are not seeing my guru, they are only seeing me. And they have their own estimate of me. When they see me behaving in an unrighteous manner, not unworthy manner, what would be their opinion of my guru? What kind of fellow is this? If this fellow is like that, his guru also must be even more unworthy. So we should be very careful, because I am seeing it. How many people, you know, just to give an example, in the beginning when I came here, there was this one lady who was the guru, disciple of my predecessor. And she came to attend my talk. And, you know, I tell sometimes these small stories, jokes. Why, do you know why I tell these jokes? Just to keep you awake. It's one of the most important functions. Otherwise, you go to sleep. So, and everybody enjoyed it, at least seemed to enjoy it. And then we went outside, met there. This lady came and, "Swami, you can never tell a story like my guru does." I told, "Yes, that is absolutely true," which is very true. Swami Bhavyanandaji was a marvelous storyteller. In fact, when he used to come to Delhi, we used to surround him and tell, "Maharaj, tell some jokes." He was a marvelous storyteller. He has beautiful stories, and the way he tells stories, that is very important. Because most of you may be knowing a joke, but when you tell a joke, others do not see it as a joke. And if you say, "Arey, you fellows start laughing, I told you a joke," then you consider it as a joke. It's a way of telling is there. So these kind of comparisons, very often we find comparing one guru, our gurus with other gurus, considering as... And then another point related to this factor is, supposing the guru passes away, then afterwards somebody criticizes your guru. You know, there are so many ignorant people, there are so many non-believers, and they want to hurt you also, or knowingly or unknowingly, suppose they criticize your guru. What should be your reaction? Should you feel pain? Because if you feel pain, that feeling pain has two aspects, two reasons. One reason is because you revere your guru as God himself. To hear somebody speak ill of him is very bad. But the other is because you develop inferiority complex. That means you accede to the opinions of other people. This is like a very superficial type of devotion. If your devotion is so deep, even if the whole world criticizes him, you will say, "I don't care. I know what my guru is. My devotion will not become less, even a bit." But the other is, "Oh, my guru is criticized." As though the person has criticized me and my 14 generations. Sometimes, you know, if anybody criticizes you, you may not mind. But if anybody criticizes what is yours, you know, your daughter or your son or even your dog, that's because we suffer from a deep sense of inferiority complex. We have to be very careful about it. Because we have so much deep devotion for the guru, we know the greatness of the guru, but we are pained because we are disciples, we should not hear the insult of our own guru. That's a different issue. But
if we are depending, if somebody praises our guru, our blood pressure goes up. Somebody criticizes our guru, our blood pressure goes up. That is a sure sign of non-devotion to the guru. What does it matter? Our guru is like a mountain. If somebody comes and gives a punch, who is the sufferer? We should have that kind of confidence in our guru. And so, we should not feel proud because our guru is praised, or we should not think we are great because of our guru's greatness. Neither should we feel pained because somebody else is passing some unintelligent remarks about our guru. These are some of the important points we have to discuss. Until we overcome this kind of tendencies which we had discussed, we will not make progress in spiritual life. And finally, guru is the greatest symbol of God. In fact, this whole universe is nothing but a symbol of God. That is why there is a upasana or a vidya, is a mode of contemplation in the Upanishads, which says, contemplate this whole universe, Virat, as God himself. So the next topic in this series of talks would be that since we are still far away from our goal of becoming even a true devotee of God, to advance in this path of devotion, we have to take several aids. And the most important of these aids, that which help us, is called symbols or symbology. What are symbols? How many types of symbols are there? And how these symbols can help us progress towards God? What are the dangers involved if the symbolism is not properly understood and wrongly applied? This would be the very interesting topic I will discuss from my next class. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.